Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Stretch. Get it all out. It's really good.
Emily Kelsall is stretching as though she's warming up for a run. But the 25-year-old climate activist is actually getting ready to sit down with me on a park bench to tell her story. Emily is about to lay bare how the threat of climate change scared her, caused her to take actions that led to jail, and then nearly destroyed her mental health. I'm Laura Lynch, by the way, and you're listening to What on Earth? And I'm starting here with my first chance encounter with Emily. It was here, on this path above the ocean in West Vancouver.
The first time I saw you was down at the other end.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who you were then.
Yeah.
And you were sitting on a rock cross-legged and you looked like you were meditating.
I might have been.
I thought so.
So she was a stranger to me, but after chatting that day, we discovered a coincidence. Emily's mother, Andrea, had actually written to the show nominating her as a climate hero for what she called Emily's painful daily battle with anxiety and depression. And Emily was more than willing to talk.
What struck me that day, aside from the sheer coincidence, was the fact that you were so willing and wanting to share your story. Why was that? Or why is that, I guess?
I think the story that I've lived and I've experienced maybe parallels a lot of other people's experiences as well. And I'm also excited to tell my story because my story has a lovely conclusion. And so I'm like happy to share the full arc.
All right, just a warning. Some listeners might find parts of this story hard to hear about. We'll be talking about severe mental health struggles. And it's important to note Emily is going to tell her story knowing there will be some who criticize her actions. But Emily is sharing it as a way to help people understand the extreme nature of the climate anxiety some people are now experiencing and how she came through it. And later on, I'll speak to two people who research mental health and climate change about the issues Emily's story raises. So here we are back once again on this West Vancouver trail where we first met. Her dad is here for support, and he's sitting nearby as she starts talking.
So I was always an anxious kid growing up. Like, I had a lot of anxieties and phobias. I was scared of elevators. I was scared of escalators. I was scared of bridges, going over Lionsgate Bridge. I was sure it would collapse. But when I found out about global warming, it shook me to my core. I was like, this can't be true. I was so worried. And I would like obsessively check with my mom. I'd be in the back of her car looking at the temperature gauge when I was just a little kid. And I'd be like, is this normal? Is this temperature normal? Any sign I saw of the world changing or getting warmer really impacted me. So I was sort of in this state of denial for a long time where I would like Google on my little iPod touch being like, is climate change a hoax? But then I grew older and I sort of accepted that it was happening.
By the time she was 14 or 15, Emily had jumped headfirst into activism as a way to combat her anxiety. She'd gotten involved with local kids' climate action groups and with a national group called Our Horizon, working to get labels pasted on gasoline pumps warning about the effects of climate change.
I was doing activism and sometimes it felt good, but below it there was something I hadn't dealt with, which was this huge burden of guilt and responsibility. I had sort of like concocted the story in my head that it was my destiny to save the world. And, you know, I had it all mapped out in my head. I would do it by the time I was 20, climate change would be solved and I could relax, right? I could just spend the rest of my life chilling out and writing plays and kicking my feet up in a small town somewhere. But the things that my brain was telling me to do, a lot of the times they were like bordering on obsession. well, not bordering, they were obsession. And while I was dealing with this, I was also dealing with a lot of other mental illnesses. I had depression, anxiety about things unrelated to climate change. I had OCD type symptoms, you know, just like a myriad of things. And that also bled into my activism as well.
Yeah, the burden she felt eventually pushed Emily to more extreme forms of activism. One example, she says she spent time sitting in a tree in Burnaby, BC, with a group dedicated to stopping the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project. TMX is twinning the Alberta to British Columbia pipeline. It's a project the government has said will generate revenue it says it needs to meet Canada's climate targets. In recent years, protesters have spent time sitting in trees along the pipeline route, slowing work on the project.
Piece by piece, crews dismantled the treetop camp in the Brunette River Conservation Area in Burnaby. Trans Mountain Pipeline protesters have occupied the tree houses since December.
But that protest isn't what landed Emily in jail. She believed in what she was doing, but she says over time, it got harder and harder.
So there's kind of like two stories. One story is a story of someone that's trying to take action. And then underneath, there's this dark, I guess, shadow self of someone who's taking actions compulsively, not because they want to and feel that it's the right thing to do, but doing it because they feel like they have to. And if they don't, something bad's going to happen, or the blame is on them. And they're two different sides of my story. So the tree stuff, for the most part, was very legitimate. And it was like a part of me and what I wanted to do. And I had a good group of friends, and we sat in the tree and we delayed work. I was doing everything I could, but my brain was pressuring me to do more. And it was, it got scary. So the tree sitting, I eventually left the tree sitting, not because I didn't believe in it, but because my anxiety reached a point where I couldn't actually do it without getting overwhelmed and consumed by this feeling that the pipeline was like my fault. And that whole time that I was doing that, I wasn't allowing myself to feel what was underneath all that, which was a lot of fear, helplessness, and grief.
Eventually, Emily came up with another way to protest the Trans Mountain Pipeline, by dressing up in an inflatable dinosaur suit and attempting to disrupt work. The group was called T-Rex Against TMX.
I started it in this period where I was dealing with all my depression and my anxiety and my compulsions. And so I wanted to do something that could potentially make a difference, but still felt like me. So it felt like this intervention where it was like not doing all the scary stuff my brain was telling me to do. Nothing violent, nothing angry. It was soft and funny and beautiful.
And then in May of 2022,
we had this concept that we were going to go jump the fence into one of the TMX work sites. We were going to set up a badminton net and play badminton in our T-Rex suits. So we had a bunch of supporters. It was T-Rex Sports Day. It was super fun. We hopped the fence. We walked down. We set up our badminton net. We lost our birdie, so we just played imaginary badminton.
So when she says we, Emily means herself and a friend who was also dressed up in a T-Rex costume. There's a court injunction, though, on that site to prevent interference in the pipeline. So the workers on site called the police.
So I turned to my friend and I was like, we got to get out of here. So we ran up the hill in our giant inflatable T-Rex suit. We hopped the fence and we turned around and the police were there. And they handcuffed us and they walked us to the police van.
In the months that followed that arrest and before she went on trial, Emily's obsessive thoughts led to yet another extreme act.
We have won the man that the government...
In this video posted to Twitter by the group Stop Fracking Around in November of 2022, you can see Emily and another person squirting maple syrup on an Emily Carr painting at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and then they kneel in front of it, saying their piece.
This is our future.
That was a little messed up. And I'm very lucky that nothing actually, like, came out of that.
Well, there was no damage to the painting, let's be clear about
that. There was no damage to the painting, for one thing. which I'm very, very glad about.
Let me just stop there for a second. Vandalizing property like a painting can lead to criminal charges. And while the gallery says it supports free expression, it calls what Emily did misguided and it condemns acts of vandalism. But Emily was never charged.
So basically, there's activism and then there's like reactivism, which are like two different things. For me, reactivism is when you are so distraught and anxious and fearful about what's going to happen to the world. And logically, in my head at the time, I thought, this doesn't really make sense. Like, why are we throwing maple syrup at an Emily Carr painting of all things? Or I don't really think this is going to have the impact that we want it to. But like, those thoughts were drowned out by this sort of like bully in my head that was like, if you don't do everything in your power to raise awareness about climate change, X and Y, Z grandchildren in the future are going to be so mad at you. So I was like, okay, I'll do it. But I didn't do it because it was out of a place of love and hope and courage and desire for a better world. But
so did you feel badly after it? I was going to ask you how you felt right after you did it.
Kind of just like, I wish I stayed in bed that morning.
Now, Emily wants to be clear. She's not saying all activists who take extreme actions are dealing with mental illness, but anxiety and obsessive thoughts were part of Emily's own reasons for the art gallery stunt. Looking back, she really doesn't feel good about what happened.
You have 50% of people or more who are like, that was the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. And then you have 50% of people who are like, go you, that's great. All that does is create this like polarization. Meanwhile, this like pipeline's getting built.
What do you say to people who thought the kinds of things that you've done are ridiculous and don't think it's right that you break the law?
Sometimes it's necessary to break the law. Sometimes the law is so unjust and so wrong that people should break it. You know, for example, like segregation between people of different backgrounds and races. That's a bad law. People should break that law. Drag queens not being allowed to perform in Florida. In my opinion, that's a bad law. That we are not allowed to fight or obstruct fossil fuel development that is going to cause the death of millions of people and species. That's a bad law. Sometimes we should feel that it is correct. Sorry, let me think about that. So sometimes laws need to be broken. Sometimes. Other times, laws are broken unnecessarily. So for example, like the vandalism on the painting, I would say maybe that's not the law that we should be breaking. If we're going to break a law, maybe we should think about it a little longer before we decide what sort of danger we're going to put ourselves or potentially others into. I think activism is something that should make people's lives better, not just in the future, but also in the present. So if we are not doing activism in a way that makes us feel empowered and alive and strong, and if we're not advocating for the values we believe in, like compassion, balance, humanity, we can't expect to build a future that we want.
This is a realization she's come to at this point in her activist journey, a journey that has included time in jail. Emily pled guilty to criminal contempt for violating that court injunction during the T-Rex badminton stunt. And in January of this year, she was sentenced to 28 days in jail for disrupting work on the pipeline. In her judgment, BC Supreme Court Justice Shelley Fitzpatrick said she believed Emily presented a very high risk of reoffending. While Emily was serving her time, her anxiety and depression ramped up.
Now, when your mother nominated you as a climate champion, you were in the hospital. You've told us you feel comfortable talking about that. What do you want to share about how and why you were there?
Sure. So after I got out of jail, there was like that part of me that was doing well and was proud to be doing what I was doing and was advocating for what I believed in. And that part was real. And then there was this other part that had been gradually grabbing control of the steering wheel. And when I got out of jail, it just got worse. It got worse and worse and worse. I was paralyzed by fear and regret and worry for the future. I was in a dark place. I was not taking care of myself. I was not eating right. It was awful. I was not, like, in my right state of mind a lot of the time. I really felt like my life was ending. Like, I felt like it was only a matter of time before I did something that would seriously hurt myself. And worse than that, I felt like I needed to, or I had to, you know, or the worst case scenario of climate change would happen. Like, I felt like I had all this power. I felt so scared of myself. So I was like, okay, sure, whatever. I'll go into the hospital. They have Ativan there. That's great.
Ativan, that's an anti-anxiety medication that Emily has found to be helpful.
So I went, I got my Ativan. I slept a lot. The sleep never felt like it was enough. And when I told the psychiatrists what I was feeling and what I was thinking about climate change and what I felt I had to do, the psychiatrist was kind of confused because, like, climate change is a real issue. So do you just want to take action on it? Like, what's your deal, right? And so, like, a lot of the time psychiatrists would hear my anxiety and hear what I felt, like, compelled to do, and they'd be like, you don't have a problem. Luckily, I had a psychiatrist, and I thanked him later. He admitted me.
Over time, she says the doctors told her she was improving, but
I was not. I was just getting better at keeping the fear and the darkness inside. I was not getting better, but I was just like, I just want to emphasize, dark, dark place. I felt like my life was going down a funnel. Like, there was nothing I could do. It was gravity. Gravity was just pulling me towards this bleak, dark end. And my anxiety and mind was working in a way where I felt if I didn't go to this bleak, dark end, climate change would be my fault. I'd be living with this burden and responsibility. I'd be a coward forever. You know, it was really bad.
But then something unexpected happened.
I was on the unit and I was spending my days playing Scrabble, taking Ativan, writing as much as I could. And I noticed there was this monk in the unit and it caught my attention because he was in full monk garb. And he was a patient, and I was like, why is there a monk in the psych unit? So I went, and I talked to the monk. And he kind of just changed my life. And, like, after the conversation, it was so weird. It was like this dimmer switch had been lifted from dark to light. And everything changed. The colors are brighter, food tastes better. I skip when I walk sometimes. I like dancing. Yeah, my, like, anxiety's gone. A great majority of it, at least. My depression is completely gone. My OCD symptoms are completely gone. My ADHD symptoms are way better. I haven't been this happy or healthy in my entire life.
This sounds like magic. What did he say?
A lot of the things he said, people have been saying to me for a long time. You know, like, it's not all your fault. You're going to make more of a difference when you're happy and healthy. I think it was sort of the way he said it. Generally, when I was super anxious, when I was like, what if, right? Generally, people would get a little bit anxious or irritated or sort of, like, pull away a little bit. The monk was very present. He was very grounded. When I was anxious and when I cried, he was there, present. He didn't pull away. He didn't freak out. He was present with my tears. And he was like, yeah, just, like, let it out. It's better out than in. Yeah.
She says talking to that monk shifted her view of climate change.
I also looked at the world. And for the first time in a long time, I saw it as something separate than myself, which is it's complicated because, you know, we're all connected, but not in the ways that I thought or believed. And I am one person, and I cannot control the entire world. The only thing that I can do is be the best version of myself that I can be, to advocate for the things that I believe in, to do it in a way that is compassionate. I'm still scared of climate change, but for the first time ever, I'm facing my fear. So, like, before I would see something that scared me, like a dying tree or a smoke in the air, and I would immediately start worrying, and I would leave my body. And now I'm kind of coming back into my body, and I'm allowing myself to feel the fear and the helplessness underneath that fear, which I didn't let myself feel for a long time. And then I say, you're safe, you're allowed to feel what you're feeling, I'm here for you. What you're feeling makes sense. It makes sense that you're sad or you're angry during the climate crisis, and I've got you. You can trust me. We're going to do what we can. We're going to do our absolute best. And that helps a lot to give myself compassion.
So what does the future hold for Emily? Well, she's not giving up on climate action, but she is taking a little time off for now to feel her feelings and, as she put it, to acclimatize herself to climate change.
Before, I was so mad. I had so much anger. I had anger at, like, politicians. I had anger at people that were building these pipelines. I don't feel that way anymore. I think it's a lot more valuable to show compassion to people and to give people room to exhibit growth, and to say to a politician, we don't have to agree on everything, but let's work together to make a better future. You know, the people that are building the pipelines, they deserve a future where they can make money and work on projects that aren't also going to damage their future. We as people deserve a future where we can be happy and joyful and believe that there is hope for the future and not be oppressed by fear and sadness and anxiety.
Emily is not sure what direction she'll eventually take. She loves writing and wants to tell stories that help people make sense of what's happening in the world.
I also eventually want to start working with politicians and other young activists to form collaborative relationships to pass bills and to make changes that radically decrease our carbon emissions.
Now, in all of this, Emily knows she lives a life of privilege. She's had the support of her family and access to treatment for her mental health. But she worries about other young activists and whether they're doing what's right for them.
I think people that are worried about climate change, which is a lot of people, and people that suffer from climate anxiety, which is a lot of people, they can be taken advantage of. You're doing something, like I said, not because it might have the most amount of impact, but because you feel like you have to do something, anything, to make a difference. So I think as activists, and if you're a leader and an activist, it's really important to check in with the people that are doing the work and make sure that they're calm, ready, and informed and emotionally supported when we're doing this work.
One other thing, she sees a need for more mental health professionals who have a true understanding of climate anxiety.
And unless we have healers and helpers and psychiatrists and psychologists who have done that work to process and really be able to be there with people who are still processing, we're still a long ways off.
Can you be a support for others now?
I think so. Yeah, I'm actually really proud of myself. I've had some activists a couple days ago ask me for some advice, and I was able to be there for them and sit with their emotions and feelings, and I felt really proud of myself. I think that's another thing that I learned, is that we can never lose hope. You know, even in the times where I was thinking, it's it for me, I had this survival urge to keep going. And sometimes I thought that survival urge was weak. I thought it was selfish, you know, to want to keep living. Now I see it as fundamental to who I am. And I think people should never give up hope, whether it's for themselves or for the climate as a whole, because, like, things can change on a dime. And I've learned that firsthand. So we always have to go forward thinking that things could go up from here, because we really never know.
So as Emily says, she is feeling much better. But if you or someone you know is struggling, there is help available. You can call Talk Suicide Canada at 1-833-456-4566. Again, that's 1-833-456-4566. Or between 4 and midnight Eastern Time, you can text 45645. That is 45645. And you can find more resources at suicideprevention.ca. That's all one word, suicideprevention.ca.
Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What on Earth? I'm Laura Lynch. We just heard Emily Kelsall's story of how mental health and climate change can become such a challenge. And I've got two people with me now who are going to try to put her experience into context. Abhay Singh Sachal is the founder of the nonprofit group called Break the Divide. He's researched the mental health of climate activists as a student of global health at the University of Toronto. Gina Martin has also researched climate change and youth mental health. She's an assistant professor in the Faculty of Health Disciplines at Athabasca University in Alberta. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Laura. Great to be here.
Abhay, I just want to start with you. When you heard Emily Kelsall talk about the intense climate anxiety she's felt, how does that compare with what you've heard from other young people?
Yeah, no, it's something that all young people are feeling when we think about it. Like, the statistics show up, but from the stories I've heard and from my own experiences, like, climate emotions are very real. And I think something that came through in Emily's story is that it's not just anxiety. It's really complex feelings of grief, of loss, of helplessness, of hopelessness. But how that weaves in with feelings of hope and opportunity and excitement. And I think what Emily really said that really resonates with me and my experience is this sense of this individual burden of climate action. When I was 14, I had the opportunity to travel to the Canadian Arctic through the Students on Ice Foundation. And I was with 200 scientists, historians, and musicians and students from around the world. But when I went to the Arctic, I went in with the impression that it would be my job to solve climate change. And I had this immense burden on my shoulders. And Emily said a very similar thing, that she felt like she had to solve climate change. But it sounds like through Emily's experience, by the end of her journey and where she's at right now, through community and recognizing that she is connected with other people, that she feels stronger. I feel the same way. I know that in community, I'm stronger. And I know that young people are recognizing that it's only by changing the ways that we got to the situation and reinventing the way that the world works that we can solve the climate crisis.
Gina, Emily had anxiety even before her real awareness of climate change, but that quickly became her focus. How can climate change add to the struggles for people who are already dealing with mental health challenges?
What we're seeing right now is that when we're looking at the science, and it's very new, we are seeing that there's this link between climate emotions and also broader mental health issues. However, we don't really know the direction or the complexity of that relationship. So that's an area where we're seeing emerging work. But it is, you know, indicative that people who have already are experiencing mental health issues and problems, that they're more vulnerable, particularly for younger folks who are also trying to find their place in the world. And so this can all kind of compound.
Abhay, you specifically research the mental health of climate activists, and that research isn't yet published. We should make that clear. But I'm wondering if you can tell us generally what kinds of things you've heard from climate activists about their mental health.
Absolutely. I think from anxiety and deep senses of grief, one of the things that often comes up is burnout. And it's not just the burnout of working on these issues. It's the burnout that comes from using climate change as a lens to look at other issues in the world. Like, if you're looking at a tree, you look at it from the perspective of climate change. If you see cars down the street, you wonder why there isn't good infrastructure for public transit in your community. If you're looking at people walking down the street alone with grocery bags, you wonder why there's such income inequality in the country. Like, that results in this deep sense of burnout, of not only constantly acting on climate change, but constantly thinking about it and pondering it at every step. Another big thing that came up was just this deep sense of guilt and feelings of hypocrisy, like this idea that as someone with relative privilege, if you're not experiencing the direct impacts of climate change every day, or if you're food secure, or if you have certain things going for you, that you shouldn't feel bad because of climate change. And so a lot of young people wonder, like, do I even have the right to feel bad if I'm contributing to this very system?
I'm wondering on the treatment end of things. Emily admits she was privileged in that she was able to access treatment in the first place. But she also said there aren't enough climate-aware psychologists and psychiatrists who take these kinds of concerns seriously. Gina, what needs to change?
Yeah, I think that was incredibly telling. And I do think we need to have that lens working through our whole healthcare system. So there's been a push that medical schools should be including climate education, nursing schools, and we see that some organizations are making sure that they're trying to provide that sort of training. However, I think we do need to do better awareness and making sure that information gets out to the people who need it. On top of that, there's other types of supports that young people do express that they're interested in. And so we need to be able to also understand not just the supports that they can get from healthcare professionals, but what are the types of supports they can have access to in their community, what's appropriate supports, and how do we get them into the hands of people who need them?
Abby, what do you think on this point? What needs to change?
Yeah, beyond the medical system, I think there's so much work that we can do as communities to build up like resilient communities. You know, as more and more people feel the impacts of climate change, more and more people will feel anxious. And so a solution isn't just to have, you know, a therapist for every anxious person, just because that's not realistic. I think what we need more of is that deep sense of community connectedness that allows people to feel empowered in discussing their climate emotions. One really important thing that I've seen is this thing called climate cafes, like spaces where people can talk about their emotions about climate change without having to provide answers. So it's, you know, a space where you can openly express your emotions. And if you are in a place that's strongly tied to the energy sector, like yet experience impacts of climate change, you know, there are often emotions of, again, hypocrisy or guilt that come up. And those are all valid emotions. And I think you can build an immense sense of community simply by having those conversations in a way that makes people feel safe and heard.
And I hear that and think that that's a way that can branch out into all sorts of communities. And with respect to that, I want to talk a little bit more about marginalized groups. Gina, here in Canada, around the world, there are those groups that are most vulnerable to climate change. Go back to the research phase of this. How do you think that needs to be reflected into the research into climate emotions and how to handle them?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we need to be doing in terms of our research. So that means making sure that we're including diverse populations, that we are thinking beyond our context. So, for example, we're working on a study right now where we're working on developing a survey. And then we've had some connections with researchers in other regions that are experiencing different types of climate change, specifically in Bangladesh. And so we're talking about potentially sharing information and being able to use that survey in multiple locations so that we can build a better understanding. And I really liked what Abe was saying about, you know, often we're missing people who maybe are impacted by their economic dependency on the energy sector, and how do they feel? So I think it's important that we're giving space for many different people.
And Abe, with Break the Divide, you focus on mental health and climate change, as well as racism and reconciliation. So how do you see racism intersecting with climate change to affect youth mental health?
I think from an outside perspective, climate anxiety can be perceived as like an overly white, overly like wealthy privileged phenomena. But I think the ways that climate anxiety or climate emotions show up in different groups of people is worth noting, that we need to be intentional about the language that we use to talk about climate anxiety. That like someone who's directly impacted on a daily basis, like, you know, people whose homes were burnt down and lit in the fires, or, you know, people who are experiencing the impacts of wildfires firsthand in Canada right now, they might not use the word climate anxiety, but they have very genuine emotions. And I think for racialized communities in Canada, for people that are at the margins, climate anxiety might not be the front of mind, but we need to recognize as like academics in this field, but also as community builders, that climate change exacerbates all existing issues too. It worsens food insecurity, it worsens income inequality, it worsens poverty. And we can't have a conversation about climate change without connecting it back to race and colonialism. And break the divide. When we connected with youth in Inuvik in the Northwest Territories, one of the biggest things that became so apparent was an additional reason that climate change was impacting the mental health of youth in the Arctic was because climate change is seen as a colonial imposition. It's not something that the youth in the Arctic have caused. They've done nothing to deserve it. Yet, much like all other aspects of colonialism, it's inflicted upon their communities and they're experiencing the brunt of the impact. And I think it's worth noting who's often left behind in these conversations. Even when we think of the wildfires and wildfire smoke, you know, British Columbia and Alberta face smoke from wildfires every year for the past 5 or 6 years. And it seems like as a British Columbian, I guess what I'm thinking here is that the conversation only becomes huge when these fires impact the power centers in Toronto and Ottawa. But even if we take that to the next level, Indigenous communities across Turtle Island have been experiencing the impacts of climate change and environmental degradation from colonialism for decades, and we haven't been listening.
There is one other critical thing I want to ask you that goes back to Emily, but it is similar for all kinds of people who get involved in climate activism. We've heard from lots of people we've spoken to on this show that their way of dealing with their climate anxiety is to become involved, to take action on all sorts of different levels. I'm wondering, Gina, what you know about whether taking action can help young people cope or whether it can sometimes be harmful.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that we want to look into more. But there's some really promising work that shows that coping in a way that's meaningful to you can be protective of your mental well-being. And I think trying to tease out what those coping strategies look like and making sure that that's centered in terms of our messaging to make sure that people are able to make the choices. There's so many things to be involved in and it can be so overwhelming. But the other positive piece of that is that there's probably something for everyone. So people can be involved if you're potentially a good writer and you want to do some writing. You can write about these issues. You can write letters and then other people can sign them and you can send them to your MP. If you're a more social person, you can join a club. You can start a club. You can go out and spend time in nature on your own cleaning up. So it's knowing that there's a lot that can be done and then being able to find that piece that, you know, really works for you in that moment. And also that can change over time and that's okay. And knowing that there's other things you can contribute. And I think that that's really important too.
Okay, I just want to finally ask you, we're heading into what we're told is going to be a hot summer, already have been, as we know, unprecedented levels of intense forest fires. Are there resources you can recommend to people who are feeling overwhelmed by climate change? Abe, let's start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton of resources that exist out there. At Break the Divide, the nonprofit that I've been working on for many years now, we're developing a program that's launching very soon to connect young people across Canada to talk about their climate emotions and share how it impacts their local communities. You can check us out online. You can check out the Climate Mental Health Network based in the States, but has a lot of really important and powerful resources. And the Mental Health Climate Change Association has some great resources as well. I think there's a great organizations out there, but I think another just big part of this is like, this work doesn't have to be external. A lot of it starts internally, like feeling your feelings. Something that Emily talked about is something that I've been thinking a lot about. Like, how do I let myself feel my feelings about climate change, feel my feels, and use those emotions to guide how I take action? Like, hope doesn't always have to be the end goal. I was recently on a panel with Ali Rouget, who's the co-founder of Fridays for a Future Toronto. She talked about how anger often does motivate her, but she has it at a healthy level where she's still able to live her life. I often think about the ways that I feel anxious and frustrated with the ways that things are going, but that still motivates me. I think if we can build up local action that is both connected to your emotions, that is aligned with your values, uses your passions, but also is, I'd say on a third front, is connected to your community. Like, what are the communities that you're connected to, and how can you work within those spheres of influence? How can you harness the knowledge of your communities to take action? And so in terms of a resource for taking climate action and dealing with your climate emotions this summer, I'd say think about your positionality, your emotions, think about your identity and your communities. All of that together can be a guiding point to take action.
Gina, what recommendations do you have?
The one thing that we've been hearing a lot from young people, so these were more school-aged, you know, when we asked them about the supports, what kind of things they were doing to support themselves through their difficult emotions, a lot of them were looking for information and doing self-research. But then when we asked them what their desired supports were, many, many young people were saying they wanted accessible information and from a trusted source. So I think that's a place where we can do better in terms of serving young people, is coming up with a way of getting the information that they want and finding out how they want it and who are these trusted sources, like who do they trust the most and how do we get the information to them that they want and need. And again, we heard a lot around wanting peer support networks. So that's why it's great to hear Abby talking about what they're working on at Break the Divide.
All right. I just want to thank both of you so much for sharing your time and your insights on this really important subject. Thank you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's always nice to talk to you, Abby. I find you so inspirational.
No, thanks, Laura. And great to share space with you, Gina.
Yeah. Thank you, Laura.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.